Chapter 12. The Path Well Traveled. Given a choice between a hypothesis and an experience, go with the experience. Someone asked me the other day how I was losing weight. I told them I eat less than 20 grams of carbs a day. They proceeded to freak the heck out, told me how dangerous it was, no, asked me if my doc knew, yes, told me that carbs were essential to human survival. Finally, I was like, dude, do you really believe I was healthier, 90 pounds heavier than I am now? I really think he wanted to say yes, but was worried I was going to punch his lights out. He probably would have been right. Rochelle Plutz on her Instagram account, hashtag eat bacon, lose weight. The question Rochelle Plutz asked speaks to the very heart of this endlessly controversial subject. Dude, do you really believe I was healthier, 90 pounds heavier than I am now? Ultimately, the goal is to be healthy. Whether 90 pounds are lost or 10, it's quite possible that a way of eating that induces fat loss becomes harmful as the years go by. Rochelle's experience presents a good case study. Rochelle had wrestled with her weight throughout her life and had tried to eat healthy by the conventional definition. When she began her LCHF ketogenic program, she weighed 380 pounds. She would eventually lose 150 pounds, documenting it all on her Instagram account and settling in at 230 pounds. Her husband lost 75 pounds, eating as Rochelle did. Her teenage daughter dropped 50 pounds. They came to believe, as do I, that if they now changed how they were eating, if they went back to eating even healthy carbohydrates, say from whole grains or from beans and legumes, and of course cut back on the butter and bacon, they would eventually gain the weight back. They consider this to be a way of eating for life, out of necessity. Are they healthier for doing so? When I first wrote about, and still barely understood, the paradox presented by LCHF ketogenic eating to the medical community in my New York Times Magazine cover story in July 2002, I admitted to trying the Atkins diet as an experiment and effortlessly losing 25 pounds by doing so. Those were 25 pounds I had essentially been trying to lose every day of my life since I'd hit my 30s, despite an addiction to exercise and the better part of a decade, the 1990s, of low-fat, mostly plant-healthy eating. I avoided avocados and peanut butter because they were high in fat, and I thought of red meat, particularly a steak or bacon, as an agent of premature death. I ate only the whites of eggs. Having failed to make noticeable headway, I had come to accept those excess pounds as an inescapable fact of my life. When I changed how I ate, and not, as far as I could tell, how much, those pounds disappeared. At the time, I was simply fascinated by the experience, feeling as though a switch had been flipped, which I now understand to be the case. But I also acknowledged in the article something that remained true for years afterward. My anxiety. Every morning when I sat down to my breakfast of eggs with the yolks and sausage or bacon, I wondered whether, how, and when it was going to kill me. I didn't worry about any lack of green vegetables in my diet because I was eating more of them than ever. I worried about the fat and the red and processed meat. Despite all my reporting and my journalistic skepticism, my thoughts on the nature of a healthy diet were a product of the nutritional belief system that had become firmly ensconced as I was becoming an adult, the theories, or technically hypotheses, of what constituted a healthy diet. Bacon, sausage, eggs, yolks anyway, red meat, and copious butter were not included. After 20 years steeped in a low-fat paradigm, I wrote in that 2002 article, I find it hard to see the nutritional world any other way. I have learned that low-fat diets fail in clinical trials and in real life, and they certainly have failed in my life. I have read the papers suggesting that 20 years of low-fat recommendations have not managed to lower the incidence of heart disease in this country, and may have led instead to the steep increase in obesity and type 2 diabetes. I have interviewed researchers whose computer models have calculated that cutting back on the saturated fats in my diet to the levels recommended by the American Heart Association would not add more than a few months to my life, if that. I have even lost considerable weight with relative ease by giving up carbohydrates on my test diet. And yet I can look down at my eggs and sausage and still imagine the imminent onset of heart disease and obesity, the latter assuredly to be caused by some bizarre rebound phenomena, the likes of which science has not yet begun to describe. Little meaningful evidence existed then, as I also noted, to ease these anxieties. A critical fact in this debate, indeed the reason it continues to exist at all, is that we still have precious little evidence. What we want to know, after all, is whether LCHF ketogenic eating, rather than, say, a Mediterranean diet or a very low-fat diet or a vegetarian diet, will not only lead to more or less weight loss, but will kill us prematurely. To establish this knowledge in any reliable manner, we have to do experiments, the finest of which known to medicine are randomized controlled trials. In concept, they're simple. Choose two groups of people at random. Have one group eat one diet and the other group eat another diet. See what happens. Which group of randomly chosen individuals lives longer and which has more or less disease? The catch is that it takes decades for these chronic diseases to establish themselves and to find out how long we live and the differences between groups in what is technically known as morbidity, sickness, and mortality, age at death, may be subtle. For these reasons, the kinds of experiments that shed light on this question of which are the healthiest eating patterns for all or some subset of the population require at least a few tens of thousands of subjects, and then they have to proceed for long enough, perhaps decades, to reliably determine if the subjects are getting more or less heart disease, dying sooner or later, in a way that's clearly the result of what they're eating. Medicine is a science. So the concept of hypothesis and test still holds, and these clinical trials are the tests of the relevant hypotheses about diet and health. To do these trials correctly, though, would cost a huge amount of money. Many such trials would have to be done, some just to see if the others got it right, and they are almost unimaginably challenging. The concept is simple, the reality, anything but. They can fail in so many different ways that some prominent public health authorities have recently taken to arguing that they shouldn't be done. They argue that we should trust what they think they know about the nature of a healthy diet, and that this knowledge should apply to all of us, whether we are predisposed to get fat on such a diet or not. I respectfully disagree. Absent this kind of reliable evidence, we can speculate on whether a diet is likely to kill us prematurely or is healthier than some other way of eating, i.e. we'll live longer and stay healthy longer, by applying certain rules. But we must always acknowledge that we are guessing. For instance, eating foods that humans have been eating for thousands or hundreds of thousands of years and in the form in which these foods were originally eaten is likely to have fewer risks and so to be more benign than eating foods that are relatively new to human diets or processed in a way that is relatively new. This argument was made famously in the context of guidelines for public health by the British epidemiologist Geoffrey Rose in 1981. If the goal is to prevent disease, Rose observed, which is what public health guidelines and recommendations are intended to do, then the only acceptable measures of prevention are those that remove what Rose called unnatural factors and restore biological normality, that is, the conditions to which presumably we are genetically adapted. Remove and unnatural are the operative words. Removing something unnatural implies that we're getting rid of something that is likely to be harmful. Take, for example, the advice that we shouldn't smoke cigarettes. We have very little reason to think that removing cigarettes from our lives will do physical harm, because there's nothing natural about smoking cigarettes. They're a relatively new addition to the human experience. If we're adding something that is new to our diets, hence unnatural, thinking it will make us healthier, we're guessing that the benefits outweigh the harms. There are likely to be both. Now we have to treat that new thing just as we would a drug that we think is good for us and that we're supposed to take for life, say a drug that lowers our cholesterol levels or our blood pressure. How do we know it's safe, even if it seems to be beneficial in the short term? All this is a judgment call and depends on perspective. One reason all diet authorities now agree more or less that we should cut back on our consumption of highly processed grains, white flour, and sugars, sucrose, and high fructose syrups, is that these refined grains and sweet refined sugars are relatively new to human diets. We assume that no harm can come from not eating them, and perhaps quite a bit of good. Eating or drinking sugar, for instance, might have benefits in the short run. The rush of energy might fuel athletic performance or allow us to perform better on a test in school. But that doesn't tell us whether the long-term consumption is to our detriment. Health authorities have mostly come to believe it is. The idea that we should all eat tubers, like sweet potatoes, as proponents of the paleo diet suggest, is based on the assumption that our hunter-gatherer ancestors ate them for a couple of million years, implying that they are safe. Some paleo advocates take this assumption a step further and propose that we'd be healthier eating tubers than not. But they're only guessing. It may be true. Or maybe it's true for some of us, but not for others. We have no way to tell, short of doing one of those incredibly expensive, unimaginably challenging clinical trials. When we're told that we should consume more omega-3 fatty acids, a kind of polyunsaturated fat in fish oil and flax seeds, among other sources, and fewer omega-6s, another kind of fat, it is based on the assumption that this shift in the balance of fats we ingest will make us healthier and live longer. In this case, researchers have done a few long-term trials to test the assumption, and the results have been mixed. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Nonetheless, we continue to hear that we should eat more omega-3s and fewer omega-6s because we currently consume a lot of omega-6s in our diets, from corn and soybean oil, conspicuously, and from eating animals that have been raised on corn and soybeans. And that's considered unnatural. By this thinking, we are not genetically adapted to have such a high percentage of fats from omega-6s. It might be the correct assumption, but we don't know. One reason I and others promote the idea that eating saturated fat from animal products is most likely benign is that we've been consuming these fats as a species for as long as humans have been a species. The evidence isn't compelling enough to convince us that this assumption is likely to be wrong. We may or may not have been consuming as much of these saturated fats, but we can presume we are genetically adapted to eating them. They are vintage fats, to use a term I first saw employed by Jennifer Callahan and Adele Height, a registered nurse, in their book Dinner Plans, Easy Vintage Meals. And they include some vegetable oils, from olives, peanuts, sesame, avocado, and coconuts, and all animal fats in this category. Callahan and Height contrast them to modern fats, margarine, shortenings of any kind, and industrially processed oils from rapeseeds, canola oil, corn, soy, cottonseed, grapeseed, and safflower. Vintage fats, by this thinking, can be trusted to be benign. Modern fats, not so much. This is also why we believe that meat from grass-fed, pasture-raised animals is healthier for us than that from grain-fed, factory-farmed animals. The fat content of this meat will be more closely aligned to that of the animals our ancestors ate for the past million or so years. It will be more natural. Perhaps more important, it is a way of eating that does not support the cruel and inhumane treatment that is common to factory farming operations. New foods or old foods in unnatural forms are more likely to be harmful than those foods to which we are presumably genetically adapted. This belief also ultimately underpins the conventional thinking that a healthy diet includes ancient grains, quinoa, for instance, or couscous, or brown rice and whole grains, rather than highly refined grains like white rice and white flour. Even without knowing any mechanisms for why this might be true, gluten content or glycemic index, how quickly or slowly the glucose hits our bloodstream, and absent, once again, any meaningful experimental evidence, the assumption is that our ancestors ate these grains for maybe a few thousand years in the form in which we're eating them. Hence, they are likely to be benign, at least for people who are predisposed to be lean and can tolerate a higher carbohydrate content in their diet. The caveat, of course, is that definitions of natural and unnatural can depend on the perspective of the nutrition authority. When we're parsing the latest diet advice, we have to make judgments about how the proponents of the advice define natural and unnatural. Are ancient grains natural because some populations, but not all, have consumed them for thousands of years, more or less since the invention of agriculture? Or are all grains unnatural because we've been consuming them for only a few thousand years since the invention of agriculture? Are we safe adding something presumably natural to the diet, ancient grains or tubers or omega-3 fatty acids? Or is it a better idea to remove only the unnatural elements, refined grains, sugars, some of the omega-6 fatty acids? I think the latter is the safer bet. But this too gets complicated, because as we remove sources of energy from the diet, we have to replace them. What might be the most complicating factor in how we think about how we eat is the influence of the latest news, the latest media report on the latest study that is making a claim sufficiently interesting to constitute news. By definition, that is what's new, which means it either adds significantly to the conventional wisdom or contradicts it or speaks to whatever diets have indeed become particularly faddish these days. Footnote. After my 2002 article suggesting that Atkins was right all along, I was accused of taking a contrarian perspective, not because I really thought the evidence supported it, but because it was more newsworthy and would earn me a large book contract. Reporting that the conventional wisdom was indeed right would not. The editors of the New York Times Magazine might not have even published such a version because it wouldn't have been news. The best reason to ignore the latest study results, the latest media reports suggesting we should eat this and not that, is that the interpretation of these latest studies is most likely wrong. A discussion highlighted in the media these days is what science journalists refer to as the reproducibility crisis. Some large proportion of the studies that are published either get the wrong results or are interpreted incorrectly, or maybe both. If we include those studies that are just meaningless, only 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 studies that make the press or appear on your homepage may be worth our notice. This percentage may be even smaller in nutrition and lifestyle research, in which the researchers are so poorly trained and the research so challenging to do. This is one reason the committees that decide on Nobel Prizes traditionally wait decades before acknowledging work to be prizeworthy. Far more often than not, if we wait long enough, we'll see other studies being published making the opposite claims of whatever we're reading today. We won't know which is right until long after their publication. Perhaps never. Trying to determine what is going on in the world by reading newspapers, as a famously clever screenwriter, director, journalist named Ben Hecht once wrote, is like trying to tell the time by watching the second hand of a clock. The same is true of research and science. Trying to tell what's true by looking at the latest articles published in a journal, and particularly in nutrition, is another fool's game. The best idea is to attend little to the latest research and focus instead on the long-term trends, the accumulation of studies, one hopes interpreted without bias, even if the long-term trends rarely, if ever, appear in the news. Since the heyday of the Atkins diet in the 1970s, authorities have refused to accept the notion that LCHF ketogenic eating is safe, and those that do promptly lose their standing as an authority by doing so. They believe that the fat content in foods we think we should eat instead of refined carbohydrates and sugar is too high, so arguably unnatural. Those of us who promote this way of eating can speculate that many hunter-gatherer populations lived on vaguely similar diets and perhaps even in a state of ketosis. The Inuit, pastoralists like the Maasai warriors in Kenya, Native Americans in the winter months. But we're just speculating. The unusual aspect of these diets leads to legitimate questions about risks outweighing the benefits. This is as it should be. No matter how much weight people might lose, no matter how easily, the orthodox medical opinion remains that these diets will kill us prematurely. Generations of physicians, medical researchers, dietitians, and nutritionists have been taught to believe, as was I and probably you too, that we know what a healthy diet is. We know it because this is what healthy people tend to eat. They eat fruits, vegetables, whole grains, pulses, legumes, such as lentils, peas, and beans. Mostly plants and plenty of carbohydrates. They avoid red meat and processed meats, and the fats they eat tend to be unsaturated, from plant sources rather than animal. Any radical deviation from this way of eating, regardless of weight loss, according to the consensus of medical opinion, is likely to be unsustainable and ultimately to our detriment. This is the reason the authorities convened annually by U.S. News and World Report to judge diets and tell us what to eat rank LCHF ketogenic diets as among the least healthy imaginable, regardless of the copious research and clinical experience that now argues quite the opposite. This is why two of the more media-savvy proponents of conventionally healthy eating, David Katz, a physician formerly associated with Yale University, and the former New York Times columnist Mark Bittman, a best-selling cookbook author, thought it appropriate to suggest recently in New York Magazine that losing weight on LCHF ketogenic eating, let alone maintaining weight for a lifetime, was analogous to getting cholera, an often fatal, infectious diarrheal disease. Not everything that causes weight loss or apparent metabolic improvement in the short term is a good idea, they wrote. Cholera, for instance, causes weight, blood sugar, and blood lipids to come down. That doesn't mean you want it. Despite the hyperbolic rhetoric, Katz and Bittman have our best interests in mind. Their concern is a legitimate one. The world is full of things we can do or take, medications and performance-enhancing substances, that will reverse and maybe even correct some symptoms of ill health in the short run, but will shorten our lives or ruin them if we take them for years or decades. The first rule of medicine is not actually to do well by your patient, but to do no harm. That's the Hippocratic Oath. As a recent New York Times op-ed said about a drug that seems to do a remarkable job of quickly easing serious suicidal depression, questions also remain about the safety of long-term use. Questions will always remain about the safety of long-term use of anything. Imagine that you decide to take up running as a hedge against aging. Whether you think about it this way or not, you are implicitly making a judgment about the risks and benefits of the endeavor. Would you suffer more or less damage to your joints, for instance? Will you live longer by stressing your system in these workouts, or will they kill you prematurely? Marathoners die of heart attacks too, occasionally young. Jim Fix, author of The Complete Book of Running, a bestseller in 1977, tragically died of a heart attack while out for a run. He was 52 years old. The conventional wisdom is that there are few things we can do that would be better for us, but we'll never know for sure. We know that endurance runners seem to be very healthy, but that may not apply to us. An almost universal misconception about nutrition and modern medicine, one shared by authority figures, physicians, and the journalists who cover the field, involves when clinical trials are necessary to guide our decisions and when they are not. You do not need a clinical trial costing tens of millions of dollars with tens of thousands of subjects to tell you whether LCHF ketogenic eating or any regimen from vegan to carnivore will allow you to achieve significant weight loss easily without hunger and make you feel healthier than you did. You can try any of these diets yourself and find out. It doesn't matter what clinical trials conclude. What matters is what happens to you. Try changing the way you eat, and you will find out, just as you can take a new prescription drug and learn relatively quickly whether it helps whatever ails you and makes you feel better. Clinical trials are necessary to tell us about the long-term risks and benefits of one way of eating versus another, vegan, say, compared to carnivore, the two extremes, not the short term. Those we can learn about reliably on our own. Is it safe? Is always one of two ultimate questions when considering a change of diet or lifestyle, particularly with the goal of preventing chronic disease. Does it fix what ails us? Is the other. The two questions are so intimately related that we cannot discuss one without the other. This is one of the many conspicuous problems with the argument that LCHF ketogenic eating is simply too risky, if not for the short term, then for the long. The authorities who make this argument assume, as we've discussed, that we have viable alternatives, that we can achieve and maintain a healthy weight via any number of dietary approaches, so long as we eat less, like the Mediterranean diet, which they assume to be safe. For them, the observation that lean, healthy people eat this way, not all of them, though, seals the deal. To believe that it applies to all of us, you have to believe that those of us who fatten easily, as I've discussed and disagreed with strongly, are no different from those lean folks physiologically and hormonally. By this orthodox thinking, LCHF ketogenic eating is just another of many routes to doing what's necessary, restricting calories and eating less. It's seen as a particularly radical way to accomplish that, and radical ways to do anything are unnatural and entail, by definition, considerable risk, hence a relatively high likelihood of doing harm. According to orthodox thinking, eating a conventionally healthy diet as lean and healthy people appear to do, but less of it, is clearly an alternative for heavy people, one they can assume to be safe. These authorities simply will not confront the possibility that eating less or not too much of a conventionally healthy diet will not fix what ails many of us. If eating a conventionally healthy diet, but less of it, and achieving and maintaining a healthy weight by doing so is not a viable reality for us, then this argument falls apart. It's also critically important to understand the basis of the faith upholding these arguments. The authorities who make them, whether they are the experts convened for U.S. News and World Report, or the U.S. Department of Agriculture's dietary guidelines, or the Katzes and Bittmans of the world, or the well-meaning friends, dude, who advise us to ease off the bacon, derive their opinions not from experience, but from theoretical concepts about a healthy diet. They have merely embraced, as virtually all of us once did, the conventional hypotheses about the nature of a healthy diet. This way of thinking seems intuitively obvious and seems to work for them. In this sense, it's helpful to think of the half-century-old controversy about the nature of a healthy diet as a conflict between hypothesis and experience. Footnote: I owe this way of thinking about the diet-health conflict to Martin Andre, a physician in British Columbia, who made this observation when I interviewed him in the fall of 2017. On the one hand, we have ideas about how best to eat to be healthy, ideas we think are true or that seem to be true. On the other, we have what physicians observe in their clinics and what happens to us, what we experience when we try different diets. The conventional wisdom on nutrition is dominated by the hypothesis that saturated fats cause heart attacks by raising cholesterol levels, specifically the bad cholesterol in low-density lipoproteins, LDLs. This hypothesis has dominated orthodox thinking on diet and health, much as the One Ring in J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings rules them all. Hence, eating polyunsaturated fats from corn, soy, or canola oil instead of saturated fats, by implication, will make us live longer. The ideas that we should avoid animal products, red meat, eggs, and dairy in particular, that they do us harm, and that we will live longer and healthier lives if we eat a mostly or all plant diet, are also based largely on the fear of saturated fats. Physicians and dietitians are expected to base their diet and lifestyle advice on these hypotheses, but they have no way to know whether their advice makes a difference. When a patient dies, as all eventually will, regardless of age or cause of death, regardless of whether her cholesterol levels changed or not, the physician is privy to no information about what role the low-fat diet might have played. By the same token, should I die tomorrow, or in my 100th year, my next of kin will not know if my unconventional high-fat eating shortened my life or lengthened it. Critics of my nutrition work will insist that the fat killed me prematurely regardless. But they'll be guessing. Maybe Jim Fix would have had his tragic fatal heart attack a decade younger had he not taken up running. Maybe he would have died in his early 50s regardless. We'll never know. Even if we had strong clinical trial evidence to support these hypotheses, which we don't, we wouldn't know the answer to these questions. The hypotheses and the evidence on which the authorities come to these conclusions, i.e., to embrace these assumptions, suggest only that we're more likely to live longer if we eat conventionally healthy diets and exercise. Not that we will. So we will have to make a risk-benefit analysis as to whether the likelihood that we'll live longer makes it worth engaging in the relevant behavior for the rest of our lives. This raises another obvious question. If the authorities are right, for instance, that eating saturated fat will shorten our lives, can we quantify it? How much longer can we expect to live if we restrict our fat consumption? This is yet another question the authorities seem to avoid, perhaps because the answer is not to their liking. If the conventional wisdom is right, and eating saturated fat raises your LDL cholesterol, as for many of us it will, and so gives you a heart attack and kills you prematurely, how many years of life would you have gained if you avoided fat-rich foods, and particularly those with saturated fat, or replaced at least some of that saturated fat from animals with polyunsaturated fats from seed oils, as the authorities concerned with our heart health advise? In other words, assuming the experts are right, what kind of culinary sacrifice is our fear of saturated fat worth? As I noted in my 2002 New York Times Magazine article, the answer to that question was worked out long ago by three groups of researchers, all in agreement, at Harvard, published in 1987, at McGill University in Montreal, and at the University of California, San Francisco, both 1994. These researchers estimated the benefit to longevity if we cut our fat consumption by a quarter and our saturated fat consumption by a third from what we might have typically eaten back then, lowering our cholesterol significantly. And they all concluded that, absent other serious risk factors for heart disease, we'd live on average from a few days to a few months longer. As one of these researchers pointed out to me when I interviewed him, the added time is not in the prime of our lives, but rather at the very end of our lives. This seems obvious, but it's a point worth pondering. Instead of dying, say, in March of our 75th year, we die in April or May. A 90-year-old is likely to get a few more months being 90, or maybe we'll make it to 91. That could be a good thing when you're 90, or maybe not, depending on the quality of your life at the time. A 60-year-old is likely to gain only a couple of extra weeks. It's not even clear that this dietary intervention prevents any heart attacks. Even in the best of all worlds, it may delay them merely by those few weeks or months. After the 1987 Harvard analysis was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, Marshall Becker, a professor of public health at the University of Michigan, suggested that avoiding fat or saturated fat to prevent heart disease is analogous to stewards rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Even that analogy, though, assumes that all the fat-restricted diet does is prevent heart disease and doesn't do us harm, for instance, make us fatter and more diabetic because of its carbohydrate content. There is another way to parse the statistics of population averages, and this is the one the authorities seem to prefer. It is indeed possible that a few of us will die prematurely, perhaps at 50 instead of 80, as a direct result of elevated cholesterol. If those people eat a cholesterol-lowering diet, they will live significantly longer. But they don't know who they are in advance. Nobody does. So we all have to eat the cholesterol-lowering diet for those lucky people to benefit. The rest of us would get no benefit at all. We may even be harmed by such a diet, as many doctors now believe. In 1999, one of the legendary experts in cholesterol research, Scott Grundy of the University of Texas, described this to me as the "I have to eat a low-fat diet for life so my neighbor down the street doesn't get a heart attack" scenario. 99 out of 100 of us who avoid butter and bacon for a lifetime may well do it for no health benefit whatsoever, even if the conventional wisdom on saturated fat is right. Physicians who embrace and prescribe LCHF ketogenic eating believe that these conventional healthy diet hypotheses are refuted daily in their lives and in their practices. After all, many of them and their patients had lived and eaten by these conventional guidelines while they got progressively fatter and sicker, as had I. Some had been vegetarians, even vegans. But LCHF ketogenic eating was what eventually allowed them to easily lose their excess fat and reverse any progression toward hypertension or diabetes. That's what they directly observed, and that, in turn, is what their patients experience. No faith is necessary to observe or experience these benefits. Recall what the 100-plus Canadian physicians wrote in HuffPost about their observations, their experiences, when their patients embraced LCHF ketogenic eating. What we see in our clinics: blood sugar values go down, blood pressure drops, chronic pain decreases or disappears, lipid profiles improve, inflammatory markers improve, energy increases, weight decreases, sleep is improved, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, symptoms are lessened, etc. Medication is adjusted downward or even eliminated, which reduces the side effects for patients and the costs to society. The results we achieve with our patients are impressive and durable. Physicians who now prescribe these diets commonly say that they rarely, if ever, prescribe drugs to their patients for blood sugar control or hypertension. Rather, they de-prescribe. They get patients off medications. That's compelling testimony. One physician I interviewed put this trade-off in perhaps its starkest perspective. Caroline Richardson is a family medicine doctor at the University of Michigan and a health services researcher who also works for the university's Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation. She started her career doing physical activity research and then gradually transitioned into diabetes prevention. For years, she told me, she counseled her patients to follow the Diabetes Prevention Program regimen of low-fat, calorie-restricted diets plus exercise. Most of her patients, though, were extremely obese and half were diabetic. Slowly, she shifted into studying and prescribing LCHF ketogenic eating, typically after finding out how well a relatively low-carb diet worked for her. Now, Richardson tells her patients to read Always Hungry, Conquer Cravings, Retrain Your Fat Cells, and Lose Weight Permanently by David Ludwig, a physician and professor of nutrition at Harvard, and to study its low-carb recipes. One thing I love about the low-carb, high-fat diet, which I say again and again to my patients, is it makes you feel better. The situation is similar to that of exercising, she told me. She advises her patients to exercise not because they'll be healthier 5 years from now. She suggests they do it because they'll feel better now. When my patients cut out the carbohydrates, every single one comes back saying, "Wow, I feel like a new person." And one thing my patients tell me all the time is, "I don't care if I die in 10 years. I feel like crap today. I want to stop feeling like crap today." Dan Murtaugh's take on this trade-off is also worth hearing. Murtaugh is a general practitioner working in Northern Ireland with a patient population of mostly middle and working class families. He told me that when he was in medical school, he graduated in 2002, he heard little discussion about an obesity or diabetes epidemic. By the time we spoke 15 years later, he was diagnosing a new case of type 2 diabetes in his clinical practice weekly. He became interested in diet and nutrition in 2009 when a patient asked him about the safety and efficacy of a paleo diet. Murtaugh did his homework and went down the rabbit hole. First, he read The Paleo Diet by Lauren Cordain, the Colorado State University exercise physiologist who did the formative thinking on this way of eating. That led Murtaugh to books on LCHF ketogenic eating. He says the arguments in these books, including mine, made sense to him, so he experimented on himself and then tried it on his patients. "It's all very well waxing on about what you think is going to happen on these diets," he said to me, "but eventually You have to roll up your sleeves and get to work and see what happens. When I interviewed Murtaugh, he told me about several patients whom he had counseled to avoid carbohydrates and to replace those calories with natural vintage fats. About one diabetic patient, not particularly heavy set, he said, "I don't think remission is a strong enough word for what happened to his diabetes." He described another patient in his early 50s as textbook obese, 6'1", 320 pounds, on his way to becoming diabetic, but already with fatty liver disease, gout, and hypertension. Prior to changing how he ate, this patient was taking two medications daily for his blood pressure, another medication for his gout, and another for chronic indigestion and heartburn. After a year of LCHF ketogenic eating, he had lost upward of 110 pounds and was medication-free. Surely, he was healthier. But Murtaugh's medical colleagues, who were still bound to the conventional thinking, were not sanguine. "I discuss the same patients with them I've discussed with you," he said, and he gets pushback. "I'm thinking, look, you're telling me I should go back to this patient who's lost 110 pounds and got off all his medications and tell him to go back to eating his bread and cut the fat off his bacon." The fact that LCHF ketogenic eating produces such remarkable results in the clinic has always represented a tremendous challenge to the conventional thinking on nutrition. It creates an essential conflict, a cognitive dissonance between two seemingly mutually exclusive definitions of what it means to eat healthy. Over the last 50 years, healthy eating has conventionally been defined and institutionalized to mean eating fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and pulses in abundance, with plenty of carbohydrates, mostly plants, and minimal animal fats and little or no red or processed meats. The other definition is what many people appear to need to maintain a healthy weight. Ideally, little or no fruit, no whole grains, no legumes or pulses, very few carbohydrates, and plenty of fat, which often translates to plenty of red and even processed meat. How do we resolve the discrepancy? If achieving and maintaining a healthy weight requires us to eat an unhealthy diet, are we healthier or not?